Good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning.
I'm dressed today for La Cid. And I'm happy to introduce you now to a Frenchman that most of you probably don't know, Pierre Corneille. 17th century, 1606 to 1684, a lawyer, a highly productive author, father of seven children, and an immortal French playwright. He is regarded as a classicist with a capital C, because the French Academy at the time was issuing a set of stern, concrete-bound rules that every play was supposed to follow. Corneille followed some of the rules but broke others. He is freer than the typical classicist. He's often linked with the slightly later French playwright, also classicist, Jean Racine. And if you want to know why I like Corneille so much, I'm going to read you a few comments on these two from their contemporaries. And you can try to guess why I picked Corneille for this course and not Racine. Quote, Corneille depicts man as he ought to be, Racine depicts him as he is, unquote. Or here's from somebody else, quote, this is wonderful and true. When one has seen a play by Corneille, one has the desire to be virtuous. When one sees a play by Racine, one is pleased to see that others share one's weaknesses. So you get an idea of what the difference is. Now you know why I picked Corneille for this course. You haven't lived, dramatically speaking, if you don't know this playwright. Now, the play of his that I chose, La Cid, is in a way his most famous. It's late in the Middle Ages. It's a medieval romance around 1100 AD in Spain, and it tells the story of La Cid, who was a legendary Spanish hero, the man who conquered the Arabs at the time when they were a major threat in the West, and who thereby saved the West from becoming Islamic. Cid is transliterated Arabic for Lord. So it means literally the Lord, like the master, the emperor, the conqueror of the world is the idea. As is usual for writers before the 19th century, Corneille did not invent the story. He took it bodily from an earlier source and then reworked the material, giving it his special magic. This play was performed first in 1637. And that happens to be the same year that Descartes published the Discourse on Method. And it was common in France at this time to stage medieval romances. It gave playwrights a chance to write about the unusual, the adventurous, the idealistic, the passionate, such as the feats of the knights of the past. Remember, this was the age of reason, the 17th century. And so far from being a repressed period aesthetically, audiences at the time were hungry for this kind of play. And I quote from a historian. The public, this is the 17th century French public, adored the strong man, the dominating woman, the excessive, the fantastic, in art as in life. People demanded the heroic, and heroes appeared to answer the demand. And then he puts in parentheses, today we are suspicious of the hero. Then he goes on, problems of personal honor obsessed aristocratic society. This is 17th century. Never did the duel to the death so flourish as in those days. And actually, a student of mine compiled this statistic that in the last 10 years of Henry IV's reign, 4,000 young French nobles died in duels. So there is a naturalism to this situation. And the author concludes his quote, "Today we find honor's scruples ridiculous. The 17th century would think our rejection of honor ignoble." So it gives you a feeling for the period. Now, although La Cid represents, in a way, the traditional medieval romance, it is a highly unusual play. It was incredibly popular. It inaugurated a new era in French drama because it didn't just use the romantic conventions. It was filled with youthful passion and exuberance, and combined that with total mastery of the literary and dramatic form. It was an epic-making play because it was extremely controversial. In other words, it was so free, relatively speaking. It broke a lot of the rules of the French classicists, who insisted on strict propriety on stage. When Roderigo comes to Chimène's home at night to visit her, for instance, the critics at the time were utterly scandalized, because not only did she meet her father's murderer, she did it at her home, unsupervised, in the dark. So you get the idea. One more prefatory note. We've had two heavy tragedies, which is Antigone and Othello. So I wanted you to get a chance to see a new dramatic form. This is a form originated in France, not by Corneille, but some generations earlier, but he is a master at it. And this form, for the first time, unites elements of tragedy and comedy and is given the unwieldy name of tragic comedy. And I quote one commentator. In comedy, I'll paraphrase this because the sentences are too complicated, but this is his essential idea. In comedy, the characters are non-heroic. They're ordinary bourgeois or contemporary people. They generally struggle with domestic problems or the pursuit of love in such a way as to bring out the ridiculous side of their natures or of contemporary customs. There's no danger of death, and there's always a happy end. That's the formula for comedy, ancient and thereafter. In tragedy, which is considered a much higher genre, the characters are heroic. They usually belong to the race of princes, such as in our plays, or great politicians or warriors. They're often borrowed from Greek or Roman antiquity or from the biblical past, and they are prompted by noble interests, such as political, military, or dynastic, and or by the passion of love in adventures that always result in catastrophe. Now that's has been our plays up to now. Now, tragic comedy, by contrast, gives you the best of both worlds, at least if you're an objectivist. Because like tragedy, it has heroic characters with pursuing noble values. They are not ridiculous, it's deadly serious, there is a danger of real loss or death, but like comedy, it has a happy ending. So the traditional dichotomy of tragedy versus comedy really rested on the malevolent universe idea. Either you had serious values leading to misery, or ridiculous characters who end up happily, so their happiness was meaningless. But the common denominator was the idea serious values must lose. Now, tragic comedy is really the discovery in the theater of the benevolent universe premise. And therefore, it's interesting that it occurred during the Age of Reason. And Le Cid is a marvelous, although not perfect, example of it. Now, I want to say one last prefatory warning. The play is written in French verse, with a highly complex meter and a special rhyme scheme which gives it a haunting beauty. It is impossible to reproduce this in English, to my knowledge. I have never seen a translation that even begins to capture this. Those who try to capture the rhyme in English usually do so by sacrificing the sense or the meaning to the sound of the poetry. And I strongly believe if you have to choose between meaning and poetry, you have to take meaning. Give up the poetry is my advice if you don't know French. Great as it is, I don't know a translation which captures the meaning and the poetry. So read the prose version, which I recommended. It still has a few extra lyrical passages which had to go into rhyme, so you'll get just a faint taste of it. And maybe someday, if you like the play enough, you can learn French and read the original. It's definitely worth learning French for. And I say that with my very, very inadequate French. But it is an experience to hear An expert in 17th century French, read this play aloud and follow the text if you can follow it at all. It's a chilling experience that you can't capture in English. Now let's go, that was the introduction. Number two, the plot theme. Well, my standard method is just to plunge in with something, blurt out something, and then refine it. A man is killed in a duel. Well, that's not going to get us too far. What kind of man? Why was he killed? Who killed him? So that's a dead end. So I'm giving you, this is actually historically how I got to these plot themes. I'm sort of recreating my mental processes. Well, I tried again. I got to bring the lovers in. So two young lovers face major problems. That's no good. What problems? Why? That's not yet an action situation. So I'm going to jump to a completely different thing. A princess gives up the man she loves because he's a commoner. And then I thought, no, that's completely beside the point. Because the infanta, the princess, is a subplot. It is not essential to the action. It's dispensable to the play. It's merely a variant to help stress the theme. But it is unnecessary to the plot situation or to the play, and it would have been the same play without it. So we're going to drop the infanta right now for the rest of today. Now let's try to get a little more plausible idea here. We got to get a man and his sweetheart in a duel. How about this as a beginning? A man kills his sweetheart's father. Now that's better. But why does he do it? Does he do it out of fear? Does he do it out of greed to inherit? Does he want the freedom to elope? Now, these would all be different plays. It's not yet a definite situation. Well, let's try it like this then. A man kills his sweetheart's father in order to defend his own honor. Now, that's much better. A situation, a real situation, is starting to emerge. Now I ask myself, just as a matter of logic, would it have had to be her father to have this same play? Theoretically, it could have been her brother or a revered teacher, someone who was a tremendous value to her, but the point is it had to be a major value to her if we're going to have a major conflict. You would never have this place, for instance, by something such as, in order to defend his honor, a man breaks his sweetheart's china. That would sink it. There would be no play. Theater is drama, and that means in the end it has to be life or death. Life is irreplaceable. When it's lost, it's gone forever. It's what counts, and it is what must be at stake ultimately. And that's why tragedies, they all die. Because the idea is this is the supreme value that's at stake. Now here we have an interesting conflict suggested. We have a man defending his honor, so he must have some kind of noble motive, it would seem. But it's a terrible action, he's killing his sweetheart's father. So what's up? What does this mean? Now, if you can state a plot theme that has a mystery right in the statement of it like that, that is already good. It means it's an intriguing plot situation. And ideally, if you're writing a good play, a great play, this very statement of the plot theme should perk up your ears and you say, God, that is a situation. What's going to happen? And so far, we have that. Now, I want you to notice that he is defending his honor, not his father's. Of course, factually, he's defending his father's honor because his father was too old to fight. But the real motive is he's defending his own honor because it's his obligation and his responsibility to step in at this point. So the big question now is, have we named the essence of the plot theme by saying that to defend his honor, a man kills his sweetheart's father? And I would maintain, although this is controversial, but everything is controversial, I would maintain this is not an exact statement of the plot theme. Because we owe it to the play to make our statement as universal as possible, while retaining the specificity of a concrete action situation. After all, we want to see if our play has a universal meaning applicable to all men in all eras, or whether it's restricted to being a period piece, good only as a description of a limited era. Now, a great play, in my opinion, has to have a universal meaning. It has to apply to all times and places, such as the meaning of Antigone or Othello. But if we make the man's motive, if we define it as defending his honor, that is going to be, I think, too narrow a concrete. It smacks of the feudal code, it dates the play, and it obscures its deeper meaning. So I suggest that what is at stake, the proper way to formulate it, is not the man's honor, but his morality. Now, morality is a much broader abstraction than honor. It's timeless and universal, and it's applicable whether a feudal code is or isn't in existence. Now, I would therefore put as the plot theme as follows. A man can remain moral only by killing his sweetheart's father. Now, this formulation dispenses with all references to feudalism, the honor code, dueling, etc. So the question you're entitled to ask is, can you really do it? Can you take this story, Lacide, and set it in the 20th century, make it revolve purely on matters of morality, with no reference to an honor code, and still keep the same play with the same essence? And I say, yes, you can. I did an experiment. I took the liberty of reconceiving Lacide as a contemporary story. In fact, I got so involved in it that at one point I decided to write it and submit it to a TV network or a movie studio as, you know, a movie based on Corneille. And you'll see it. It's exactly the same story, but with only the feudal stuff dropped. And this was my story. I'm just give you a taste of it, enough so you see that you can do it without any problem. And it's a good, terrific story, I think. Imagine two lovers today in the United States, a young woman and a young DA. She loves him because he is a crusader with a passion for justice. And he loves her because that is what she admires. It reflects her character too. She's not satisfied with an average guy. She wants a moral hero. Then the girl's father commits a debatable action, a controversial crime. It's justifiable from one viewpoint, but dead wrong from another. Now, it can't be a flat-out unequivocal evil, because then we would have no sympathy for the girl. Nor can it be an utterly innocent action, because if the father were purely virtuous, we'd have no sympathy for the DA out to prosecute him. So let us imagine, for instance, that the father is an MD, a medical doctor, and he commits euthanasia on a patient of his who is undergoing extreme suffering. And he's moved by pity. He thinks the situation is hopeless and the patient just does not want to go on. Yet there is an objection to his action. He's accused of moving too soon, of acting rashly, at a time when the disease was not provably fatal, and let's just say, to make the situation real, a cure is actually discovered a month later. So we have this state of affairs. The DA, with his love of justice, is indignant at the doctor and feels that he has to prosecute him. And let's say that the penalty is the death sentence. It's a capital crime to take another innocent person's life. What is the DA's dilemma? I must prosecute, but she will hate me. Well, then, I can't prosecute. I'll look the other way. But then I won't be the same kind of man. I won't respect myself, and the basis of her love for me is destroyed. She'll disdain me properly. And meanwhile, she has the same torture. Don't dare prosecute. It's my beloved father, and you must prosecute. You're a man of justice. That's what I love. If you default, you're going to torpedo the whole basis of our love. So he prosecutes and wins the case. She demands revenge. He loves her and says, I couldn't have done any differently, but I know I've killed your father, so take revenge on me, etc., etc. Now, I submit that this is the exact essence of Corneille's play, especially if you make the DA's own father the euthanized patient. So the DA, you see, is in part avenging the premature death of his own father. Now, At one point, I was all gung-ho to write this for Hollywood. with due credit to Corneille. But I do want you to see that this is a wonderful plot situation. It is really brilliant. I mean, Corneille is not mine. It's utterly brilliant. It's by far the most complex plot theme that we have had so far, because the others so far have been very simple. A girl defies somebody. A man becomes jealous. Here we have a whole structure of conflicts deliberately constructed to milk conflict. And as I say, it's not dependent on the feudal code. I just can't tell you the admiration I feel for someone who could come up with a plot situation like this, because that is just as hard to do as you can imagine. And Corneille just tossed them off. I don't know how many plays he wrote. He just came up with them. So he's a tremendous person to plagiarize if you're inclined in that direction. Now that I hope you see the universality of this play, I'm going to follow the actual concrete and talk about honor and duels in the feudal terms, just as the play does. But because I'm not going to translate the entire thing over and over. But in essence, to enjoy this play, you must be able to see the feudal situation as a symbol of a universal moral situation. If you can, you will be entirely hooked and in suspense. And if you can't see it as universal, you're just going to turn away from this and say, oh, it's old-fashioned, junk, feudal, and it just means nothing to me. So this is my statement of the plot theme. A man can remain moral only by killing his sweetheart's father. Now observe the conflicts rife in this terrific situation. What's the major conflict? The man versus his sweetheart. And here, for the first time, we come across a play where the defining conflict occurs between two characters who are both 100% good. And that's going to add a lot, as you'll see. Up to now, we've had good versus bad, or mixed versus wicked. And now we have two good characters in mortal conflict. And notice that they're both motivated by the same inner conflict. Both of them are idealists, strong moralists. They believe you must do the right thing no matter what, whether it's avenge my father and kill hers, or whether it's avenge my father and get him for what he did. But they both believe that you must do the right thing no matter what. And both are passionate lovers who are tempted to place their love above what is right. And since their love is based on their virtue, their love won't allow them to evade virtues. So their love demands the very virtue that is going to sabotage it. Now, that is what I call a great situation. There's no seeming way out. If the hero practices virtue, he loses the girl. If he doesn't, he loses her. But he's a great all-conquering hero, and nothing can defeat him. So what will he do? Can he win? How? See, all of that should be stirred up in you by the statement of the plot theme, And it should show you that you're really getting into something of an immortal stature here. All right, now let's go to Corneille's plot development. Now, I'm dropping the Infanta as a mere subplot. I always drop subplots because you need to have another whole period if you're going to go into subplots. The subplot is a story tangential to the main story, but united by the same theme, so that it's like another angle on the main theme. And it helps to develop the theme, but for our purposes, we just have to strip it right off because there's no time to go into it. So again, we have three parts, as always, in plot development. First, the establishment of the situation, and that here takes place in Acts 1 and 2. And in those two acts, we learn that Ximena and Rodrigo are in love, the two fathers quarrel, there's a slap in the face to Rodrigo's father, and Rodrigo must avenge him because his father's too old. And we have to sympathize a bit with both sides to get into the play. Ximena's father, the Count, you have to look at it that his honor has actually been insulted by Diego's statements, and in turn, Diego's bravery has been insulted by the slap in the face. And therefore, by their code, which we're here respecting just as a symbol, Diego, through the slap, has unintentionally provoked a duel. So both men, in effect, lost their temper, vying to be the bravest and the most honorable. Neither is a villain, or else you would wreck the play. We couldn't sympathize with their defenders then, their children. Now, to fully plant the situation, we have to add that the king is angry at their quarrel. He has decreed who is going to be the tutor, and this is defiance of his will. He says there isn't supposed to be any duel. And we have to plant one other thing, the dread Arabs. The Moors are around. These are the same Moors that Othello was a hero of, but this is a different time. And there are 10 enemy vessels seen in the vicinity. And then, of course, we have therefore all the makings of the situation, which comes into existence as Rodrigo kills the Count. And Ximena demands vengeance. That's the situation. Now, then the rise to the climax is the second part of the structure. And that goes from the beginning of Act 3 through Act 4, Scene 2. Rodrigo comes to Ximena to surrender. Kill me, he says. Qua moralist, he feels he deserves a medal. But qua lover, he deserves to die. Now, if it's an ordinary play, if they ever even got this far, that would be it. She'd either say, oh, it's okay, I forgive you, you had good motives. Or if she was bitter and modern and hostile, her psychiatrist would advise her to kill him and work out her catharsis. And that would be the end. But we're talking about a master of drama here. So this is the beginning, not the end. It keeps getting worse before it gets better. There's what we call the rise in intensity. And this rise, if it's to be a great play, has to be logical, not arbitrary. So what does Corneille do? Well, Ximena neither forgives nor kills him. She rejects the whole idea. She rejects the offer of suicide. And she says with perfect logic, you lived by the code of honor, and now I do. Honor demands that you, Señor Rodrigo, face a worthy adversary and die properly, morally, struggling to remain alive. Otherwise, your honor is insulted, and worse, my father is thereby being insulted. Because if you are a worthless suicide, he was killed by a wimp. Which is really tremendously logical. It's utterly consistent with her characterization and with the basic premise of the situation. So what is he to do now? She won't accept his life. He can't give her up. He can't have her. There's only one choice. He's going to die for her, but properly, nobly, in an even more monumental struggle for honor. The Moors are coming. Great. If I die a noble death, then I will die with my honor intact. I have behaved well. But if I win, which is, I'm certainly going to try to do, the king will be grateful. Shimon will be overruled by the court, and maybe, just maybe, I'll win over her heart. So we go to the top of the rising action, a vast battle with the Moors, not allowed to be shown on stage by the rules of classicism, but which would be an essential part of the movie. In any event, not my movie, I mean the traditional movie. It's total victory. Full heroism, and he comes to court afterwards, and the king proclaims him Lasid, the Lord, the all-conqueror. Now that, I think, is the climax. Now we know that he has to win out somehow in the end, because he has reached the climax of the value at stake. He has achieved in action the utmost in honor. He's carried it to its ultimate form and is recognized around the world for it. And that takes place at Act 4, Scene 2. And that brings us, therefore, to the resolution. Now, that's the third and last part. If it was an ordinary play, Shimon would capitulate here. She'd say, okay, he's a great hero, a man of honor, I love him, the end. But not Shimon. She is a woman truly of iron, utterly and totally admirable. And she says at this point, I'm sorry, but the Moors are irrelevant. He's a great guy, I love him, but his risks in wartime are not enough. Even if he had died in that war, it wouldn't be enough. Remember, she is an idealist, and she is concerned to avenge her father as a matter of moral principle. So she doesn't want Rodrigo's death as a wimp, but she doesn't want it as an act of glory either, you know, in battle with the Moors. She wants his death as an acknowledged criminal. She wants him to die by execution to avenge her father, not as a great man saving his country. Of course, she also wants him not to die because she loves him. So her response is absolutely torn and completely logical. So what is the resolution to be? He's going to win somehow, but the question is how? Shimon demands a final combat with a volunteer that she hates but hopes, and also hopes that he won't defeat Rodrigo. And the king decrees the winner's going to get Shimon. That's the end of Act 4. So again, you think, well, this has to be the end now, whatever the battle. Rodrigo's going to win the battle, get Shimon, a happy ending. But another brilliant, breathtaking turn by Corneille, Rodrigo won't fight. He says, I won't shed your champion's blood. And you see how logical again he is. After all, you're in the right morally. So again, he offers his life. And again, she won't take it. Now, Voltaire said that the flaw in this play is that Rodrigo offers suicide too many times. But Shimon remains adamant to the very end. Her last words, even when the king has ordered her to marry Rodrigo, is, quote, should I be the reward for what he does and be delivered to the eternal shame of having bathed my hands in my father's blood? In other words, marry my father's killer voluntarily? And the king mutters, well, leave it to time, your valor and your king. Curtain. Now this ending, I have to say, is not, in my opinion, exactly perfect. In fact, it's very controversial how to interpret it. It's not explicit enough as to what the final state of the lovers is. Some people actually regard it as an unhappy ending, and they think the lovers will never be reunited. But I disagree with that. The vast majority of critics regard it as a happy ending, and they think it's just a matter of time before the reunion. And there are some people who think that it's deliberately unresolved, that Corneille just couldn't go either way with it and therefore just left it implicit and up in the air. Now, my first reaction on reading it was disappointment. I felt that Corneille wanted it to be a happy ending, but couldn't, within the logic of the setup, justify or explain a happy ending. I couldn't imagine anything in logic that would ever satisfy Chimène, because it looked like she had to see him dead, or she would just never be satisfied. And therefore, I felt at first that he left it unresolved with merely the suggestion that they would be happy later. In other words, I took this as a weakness in the ending, that he was unable to deliver the happy ending, which his structure called for, but which his logic seemed to prohibit. But I have since strongly moderated my original reaction, because in talking with several French scholars that I respect very much, it's universally been told me that Corneille, if he were resurrected, would answer the logical issue as follows, and that the English doesn't make it as clear as the 17th century French does, on which I can't comment, but I know it's possible for something to be untranslatable. But this would be Corneille's answer, that Rodrigo in the final page of the play has been given a mission of atonement for having killed the Count, and a mission aimed specifically at glorifying the Count. In other words, he's undertaking the conquest of the entire world in the name of the Count's memory, and as a tribute or monument to the Count. So if he's successful, he will have avenged the Count, made the Count an illustrious name in Spanish history, and therefore freed Chimène of the need for further vengeance. Now, on this theory, the reason that the play ends without a final embrace on stage, which I strongly feel the need of always in this type of play, in any type of play, the reason that it ends without that final onstage embrace is that Rodrigo has to do a year of military battle before they can reconcile. And by one of the classicist conventions at the time was that a play has to elapse in exactly 24 hours. So they're not allowed to have a scene a year later, so he had to leave it off stage. Now, as I say, this viewpoint put forth by French scholars that I respect seems plausible to me now and makes the ending substantially better than I first thought. But I have to confess to you that I still feel that inherent in the theme, which we'll be discussing shortly, there is a conflict that can't really be resolved, and that this contributes to the uneasiness of the ending. That much as Corneille wants to, there are philosophic reasons why he cannot bring the two permanently and happily together. I just can't imagine Chimène, adamant and logical as she is, just dropping the issue of honor, even if Rodrigo defeats the entire world for her father and has placards everywhere. Because there is an inherent clash there, never fully, finally solved. There's an unsatisfactory note to me. A happy ending, okay, I grant that, mostly explained, but a residual logical doubt about the consistency with the structure and the characterization, and a deeper feeling on my part that there's a philosophic explanation for this residual hesitancy. All right, now with that, let us go to number four and look at the characters. How many indispensable characters? Well, you really need the pretext for the situation, which is the father that gets killed off. But in terms of enduring characters, there's really only two, and that is the two lovers, the man and his sweetheart. The father is just an excuse to get the war going. Now, I want to develop the theme that I mentioned earlier, that both of these characters are completely good. They both have enormous stature. They're strong, admirable, heroic. There's not an evil character in this play. And it's fascinating to me that it developed in this way, given the benevolent universe intention of the play. Because the conflict is between the good and the good. And if I can jump to Ayn Rand's books, that same principle animates all of her novels. She, of course, has evil characters, highly developed and wicked evil characters. But she always said that the essential conflict in her novels is between the good characters. For instance, between Rourke and Dominique, or Rourke and Winant, not between Rourke and Keating or Rourke and Toohey, or in Atlas Shrugged, between Galt and Dagny over the strike, or Galt versus Dagny and Reardon, not Galt versus Wesley Mouch. And she always insisted that her novels, the key conflict is between the good, and that's what gave you such a powerful sense of a clean, benevolent universe, that both sides of the central conflict were admirable. And so you came away with a sense of the cleanliness and stature of men fighting for their values, as against what it would be if the whole focus and essence of the novel were Rourke versus Keating. What metaphysical power that would have given Keating, you see. And the same if it were Galt versus Mr. Thompson, you see. Now here, Corneille and Ayn Rand are in exactly the same aesthetic position, in contrast, for instance, to Shakespeare, who couldn't dream of a situation of that type. For instance, Iago is just the antithesis of that. And what conveys the enormous malevolence is that the potent force in the conflict is depravity. And here the two characters are utterly innocent 17th century French romantics, and it completely changes the universe. Now the essence of their conflict, as I've said, continuing with characterization, is, we could put it this way, their love versus morality. We're in their characterization now. Now notice it is not, one more time, it is not a conflict between mind and body. It is not physical love for a slut versus spiritual love of virtue. If you thought it was the mind-body dichotomy, you may as well throw out the play and resign from the course, because that misses it utterly. That's putting it mildly. Each of them has a spiritual love of the other as the fundamental, and of course they want to sleep with each other as an expression of that. So it's a spiritual love of each other, or an integrated mind-body love of each other, as against the demands of morality on both of them. You can put it this way, it's love of virtue as against love of the other person, who is the human embodiment of virtue. So both sides of the conflict in both characters are noble. Both of the things each of them want is good, and therefore it's an agony that they should be in conflict with each other. Now, Corneille's great achievement was the intensity of the conflict that he could dramatize. And I'd like to make just a quick aside here on conflict in general, because that is a defining characteristic of greatness in the theater. I would say in literature more broadly, but certainly in the theater. That's why I always stress, what is the conflict? A play without conflict is, you may as well throw it out. Conflict means value clash. And that's what leads to excitement, to suspense, who will win. That's what justifies the very name drama for this form. But value, particularly we're speaking in an all positive context of good characters, value implies a real valuer. A man or woman of purpose, stature, strength. In other words, conflict developed like this implies man as a hero, the very kind of man that can fight for his values and remain true to them no matter what the conflict, no matter what the obstacles. And this is precisely what Corneille specializes in presenting. If you study this play, if we had time to go over one point at a time, there is conflict everywhere. The same kind of grand-scale conflict on the major and minor characters alike. The Infanta, the subplot, has that. Rodrigo's father has the conflict, I must fight, but I can't. Chimène's father has that conflict. Rodrigo and Chimène, of course, have it. And it's not that the same conflict is repeated boringly over and over. No, it's presented in many variants, all one way or another stressing virtue versus love, or sometimes even versus life. We'll come back to that. Now, to develop further the characterization, let us ask of the two leads in conflict here, who is the strongest? Who is the real protagonist? Well, usually you can go by the title of a play. But, for instance, Iago is definitely stronger than Othello and is the mover of the action. And I think here you can make a case that the really strongest one is Chimène. She's not given as much action, and therefore it's not really her play. But within the framework of what she does, I mean, he defeats the Moors and defeats the world, and you can't get more action than that. But she is not merely a character in love. She's got a whole moral perspective. She's willing to take on the king and the entire country. And it is her rock-hard adamancy that really drives the action. Rodrigo conquers the world. He lays it at her feet. He offers his life to her over and over. He still can't satisfy her. So he is mighty strong, but I think she has an edge in sheer tenacity of will. Now you decide tonight when you're going over your homework, who is stronger, Antigone or Chimène? And now you have a question to decide, whereas Desdemona doesn't even enter the picture. But I happen, for reasons to undoubtedly baffle you, to like plays that have strong women in them. So you're going to get even another one beside these two. But to decide between Antigone and Chimène is already a problem. I mean, of objectivity. Now to continue the discussion of the character. I'm taking the two of them together because they have the same character. I want you to note that passionate as they are the opposite of whim worshippers or emotionalists. This is the age of reason. And these characters reason out what to do at each stage. At each stage of their dilemma, they reason out the various responses. And what is so fascinating is that you see them reasoning on stage, logically wrestling with their crises. Now, you take any modern play where the hero, if you can call it a hero, does something. Why did you do it? I don't know. I just felt that way. It's about the most they can say if they even get to such a crude question as why. And you contrast that. Here you have the syllogisms flowing on the stage before the action. He's figuring out if this, then this, if this, then this, but what about that? And on top of that, even an English translation is beautiful. Now I'm going to give you a few excerpts here, one from Rodrigo and then Chimène, just randomly chosen. I want you to notice the passion of these characters, the agony of the conflict, the beauty so far as it comes across in English, which is just unnatural here. And above all, the logic as they confront their dilemma and try to figure out what to do. Now, in Act 1, Scene 3, Rodrigo, it's page 12 of the book I assigned. I've copied it down here. Just before he duels with Chimène's father, the eloquence and simplicity of the way he says it. A war is in my heart. Against my honor now my love takes part. I must avenge a father, lose my love. One fires my courage, one puts out the flame. The dreadful choice is to betray my love or live in shame. An infinite harm both courses now present. Oh God, the dreadful pain. Must an insult have no punishment? Must I punish the father of Shimei? I mean, this is fabulous. This man is father, mistress, love, fame. My fame will tarnish or my pleasure die. One brings me misery, the other shame. Better by far to die, but to die unsatisfied. So he goes on in this vein and finally decides logically that his debt is to his father. That's what is up to him volitionally to do. So he's going to avenge his father and suffer the consequences. And once he realizes it, he is, quote, ashamed that I have wavered for so long. Let me not stay in pain because today my father suffered wrong, his injurer, the father of Shimei. So he's off. Now, on Shimei's part, Act 3, Scene 1, I think this starts on page 29. She just learned of her father's death. Eyes weep your fill and drown yourselves in tears. Half of my life has put into the grave the other half. Now that is an immortal line. Half of my life, her lover, has put into the grave the other half, her father. Now, if you can write one line like that, it doesn't matter what the rest of the play is, you will survive. So that I must avenge after this deed what I have lost on what remains to me. What a dilemma. What can I hope for except an eternal torment if I must pursue a crime and love the criminal? You see, incredible clarity. It's like it's written in flashing diamonds. And a little bit later she says, despite my passion which resists my anger, I will do all I can to take revenge. But yet, despite the strictness of my duty, my sole wish is that I accomplish nothing. Now that is what you call an inner conflict. Now observe that the Infanta at one point tells Shimei to cool it. And her exact words are, it's more noble to self-sacrifice than to pursue personal vengeance. In other words, you obey the king now, cut this out, and think of the well-being of your country. Just sacrifice yourself a little for the public welfare and stop thinking only of, you know, your own revenge and your own concerns. And Shimei is unyielding. It's my father, my honor, my love. In other words, there is a pronounced selfish quality to both sides of the character's dilemma. Their sense of honor is not presented as a demand for selflessness on their part. On the contrary, they're presented as having a true hero's love of morality for selfish reasons, as a goal and expression of their personal nature. And by the same token, the author does not sneer at their love on the grounds that it's personal, selfish. So it is not a conflict between altruism on one side and egoism on the other side. It is a conflict between two selfish loves, the love of honor or the honor of love. Now, I'm going to tell you soon that there's implicitly a very selfless element in this play. But what I'm telling you now is that it's only implicit. Explicitly, it is not there. Now, Roderigo and Shimei are two examples of what has been called, and it's a common term in scholarship now, a Cornelian hero. And that is spelled, for no reason that I know, C-O-R-N-E-L-I-A-N. This means the hero is presented by Cornet. And after our 6-minute break, I'm going to give you the essence of the Cornelian hero. 6 minutes. He's man as self-made and as a being of iron will, not only free will, but the capacity for tremendous iron will, courage, passion, and rational judgment. His heroes have great self-esteem, but they exert Herculean effort to deserve it and maintain it in the face of tremendous obstacles. Now I'm going to give you a couple of quotes from commentators so you'll see how widely recognized this aspect of Cornet is, and that will perhaps explain to you why you never hear of Cornet anymore. Not in the theater, not in colleges, not on the movies. It's absolutely non-existent. And this is one, you know, obscure commentator that I dug out of the library stacks. He says, quote, "Fortified by their own energy, the Cornelian heroes have nothing to fear at the hands of destiny. They will parry its blows or bear them uncomplainingly. Fate may dog their steps, but for them it is powerless to force an entry into their hearts and alter their resolve. Man is entirely free and fully responsible," unquote. And here's a writer, I have to give his name because his statement is so good, Robert J. Nelson, a whole book on Cornet, on the Cornelian hero, which is a mixture of, like many good books, of excellent things and nonsense, you know, in consecutive sentences. But the whole trick is to figure out which is which. He's giving Cornet's definition of value, V-A-L-U-E. You remember Ayn Rand's definition? That which one acts to gain and keep. And you remember the essential argument against altruism is that life depends on achieving value, not sacrificing it. Now, this is just comes out of his commentary on Cornet. He doesn't know from anything about objectivism, of course, this man, Nelson. Value in Cornet is something to be realized, not denied. I mean, talk about objectivism centuries before. And then he has this sentence, "Cornet's heroes are always on their best behavior, for this is the only kind of behavior of which they are capable." Now you understand why I quoted his earlier remark that he shows men as they ought to be. Now hear this. This is the true romanticist credo, taken from Aristotle and practiced by Cornet in the 17th century, at least 200 years before Hugo and the other, you know, avowed romanticist movement. Quote, "Cornet shows men not only as they ought to be, but also as they might be, as they would be, as they could be, and as they have to be," unquote. And he means have to morally, not deterministically. It struck me in working on these lectures that there are four great thinkers / artists through the ages, and only four that I can think of, who have been united, whatever their differences, by the view of man as a hero, and specifically a hero unafraid of the gods or society, completely self-willed and master of his destiny. And the four that I can think of throughout all Western history are Aristotle with the great-souled man, Cornet with the Cornelian hero, Nietzsche with what we call the Superman. And you should note, by the way, that Nietzsche was personally influenced, partly directly, partly indirectly, by Cornet. By Cornet's individualism and hero worship as against the enshrinement of mediocrity. And Nietzsche is often referred to as a disciple of Cornet. So I say there are four: Aristotle, Cornet, Nietzsche, and of course Ayn Rand. And I think you see more fully why I chose Cornet and why I think it would be a tragedy for you to get through your life without knowing a playwright of this enormous value. But, shifting gears, he's not an objectivist. And he has problems working out his plays and his characters because of this. And that brings us now to his ideas, and first to his theme, number 5 in our list. Now we're getting into murkier waters. I mean, more unpleasant waters, but they're there. What is the direct message of Lacy? The primacy of honor, or if you want to take the more universal view, the primacy of morality. I'll use those as interchangeable for this discussion. The superiority of honor or virtue over even the noblest, most spiritual love, and even over life itself. So Rodrigo describes himself in the third person in Act 5 and captures the whole theme. And he says, to avenge his honor once, he lost his love. This is what he wants posterity to remember. To avenge his mistress, he has quitted life. In other words, he sincerely offered suicide. Preferring whatever hope had ruled his soul, preferring his honor to chemin to life. And that is the theme. The primacy of honor over love and even over life itself. Now, here a sympathetic commentator. These are all French scholars that you never hear of in the United States. And he writes about, here is a world, I'm quoting, in which personal honor is not a chemical reaction of gland secretions, but a self-instituted, self-administered rule of life. A world in which nothing, not even life and love, is so precious as one's honor as a man. Unquote. So the clash, as we said, is love versus honor. Spiritual love with its appropriate physical expression in sex versus spiritual honor or virtue with appropriate physical action. And now the question I want to ask you is, how can you explain such a clash between love and virtue? Now we've already taken care of, and I'm not going to repeat, that it is not a clash between mind and body. So if it's not a clash between mind and body, how can there be a clash between love and virtue? Well, you might think maybe he holds that love is irrational, that it's inherently capricious. Now, you should know already better, because their love is founded on their perception of the virtues of the other person. But just to hammer this point home, Corneille does not agree with Odes 3 and 4 of the Antigone, or with Shakespeare's view of love in Othello. He does not believe that love is irrational. The whole 17th century, especially in France, rejected the idea that there was a dichotomy between love and reason. This was the age of reason. And Corneille believes with his century that love is an expression and consequence of one's moral evaluation. And one scholar points out that there is, quote, something in common in the Cornelian psychology and the Cartesian philosophy, Descartes, namely the intellectualistic conception of love. And by that they mean love must be tied to the knowledge of the merit of the loved object. And then they give two ringing formulas in French that capture this. I just wish that I could pronounce these properly, but I'm not too good. Il est impossible d'aimer. It is impossible to love ce qu'on n'estime pas, what one does not value. And here's the other famous one. L'amour jamais ne se prend. Love never takes to itself. Oh, choses méprisables, contemptible things. Love never takes to itself contemptible things, made toujours au plus rare, but always that which is rarest, plus estimé et plus relevé. That which is rarest, most valued, and most exalted. Now, this is the literal antithesis of Christianity, of the idea of, you know, love your enemy and love weakness and love need. This is the idea of loving value, and it was the formal view of the French in the 17th century. So for Corneille, it is an act of intellect, an evaluation according to a code of values, which produces and justifies love. In other words, love is an expression of reason. So the conflict is not between love and reason, and it's not between love and sacrificial duty. So it's really baffling here to try to put your finger on what the conflict is. It's between two kinds of love. Love of virtue in oneself, and love of virtue, the very same virtue in one's beloved. And that is a puzzle as a theme. How can virtue come in conflict with a rational love of virtue in your partner? Or put the same thing another way, how can love of virtue in oneself, that's what honor is, come in conflict with love of virtue in another, which is what falling in love is in this viewpoint? Now you see, you have a real intellectual problem here to understand this theme. And to understand it is to penetrate into the essence of Corneille's official philosophic thought. Now the first thing to notice that here is that under objectivism, this theme would be impossible. Literally impossible. You could not do a play on this theme. Now I hope you're not confused by the modern play that I invented at the start, because that play hinges entirely on our ignorance of scientific facts. That's why we can be morally ambivalent about the doctor. We don't really know, even if I say that a cure is possible, how much effort it would take to cure the patient, how much future pain on his part that would entail. Is there really objective proof that a cure is possible? How much has the man already suffered? How old is he? What is his preference? There's a dozen other things that I deliberately blurred and left out. But once all the facts were known, the doctor and my story would come out either right or wrong. It would be clear cut, and that would be the end of the story. The whole conflict in my contemporary version rested on our ignorance of certain medical facts. In Corneille, however, the conflict does not rest on ignorance, but it's inherent in morality itself, because the conflict is fundamental. The same issue dominates all of his plays. He believes in some way that in pursuit of morality, you will necessarily clash with others, even though they pursue and embody the very same morality. In other words, morality is an ideal for which rational heroes have a selfish passion, and yet it often unavoidably leads to agony and even tragedy. Now, how do you explain this kind of conflict? Obviously, it depends on the content and deeper context of your code of morality. In other words, to understand Corneille's theme, we need to look more broadly at his, number six, wider philosophy. Let us start here with an analysis of the concept of honor, which is his symbol of morality. Now, so far I've taken the term loosely as pride in your virtue, but we have to be more specific. What values, according to Corneille, comprise honor? What specifically should you take pride in? What virtues in content makes a man moral? Now, I did a fair amount of research, and as far as I can analyze it, and this is my own analysis, honor for Corneille involves three unidentified components, each basically different from the other two, and all put together by Corneille and commentators alike as one big package without analysis or distinction. Now, first of all, there's an objective component in which Cornet agrees with Aristotle and with objectivism. Honor involves pride, self-esteem, strength of purpose and will, rationality. So all of that is obviously to the good. But these are abstractions, and they leave open what specific moral code to follow. You're supposed to have strength of purpose. Fine, but what kind of thing should you take as your purpose? You're supposed to have strength of will, but what should you direct your will toward achieving, you see? So all of these are generalities which acquire meaning only in conjunction with something more specific. And that brings us to the second element that comes under honor. And here, unfortunately, we have to say, without you resorting to symbols, that Corneille in La Cide does accept the feudal code. Remember, he's just come out of the feudal period. He's 17th century. And he's a strong moralist. And Christianity is weakened, and he needs a feeling of there being strong moral principles. And he, like Shakespeare, didn't know where to find it. But Shakespeare gave it. Some others turned society into God, but Corneille did it by looking to the feudal period. So to him, morality is a series of commandments binding on an individual because they flow from the class in which he was born. For instance, the Infanta's dilemma. She can't marry outside of her class. That simply is a categorical imperative. If she does, she demeans her honor. And another such categorical imperative is, you must duel to the death if you are insulted. Now, there's a whole set of these if you know the feudal period. How do you know that you're supposed to follow these? They're not revelations from God. How do you know? Well, it's in your blood. In other words, there's a definite element of biological determinism here. Now, it's not sufficient to be born into a noble caste to be moral, according to this viewpoint. But it is necessary. If you're not born into a noble caste, then you don't have this inner imperatives of how you must behave. And in fact, they wouldn't be applicable to you. You then act the way the peasants act, or some other division. But if you're born into the nobility, your choice is to obey the feudal code, which springs from your high birth, or to flout it and be ignoble. So you see, sadly to say, for all of his stress on self-assertion, when you push him to the wall, the Cornelian hero does not survey the universe independently and choose his values by his own independent rational judgment. He is born obligated to obey a set of commandments which he had no part in choosing. And this is a tremendous and tragic limitation on his autonomy. Now, the third factor in the package deal, which is not emphasized but is there, just makes it worse. And the third factor is that honor also involves the opinion of others, your status in their eyes, what they will think of your behavior. You notice how they're concerned with how posterity will remember them. Or here's a Trinity tossed off in the play as though, you know, these are just three synonyms. His dignity, his reputation, his honor. Now, could you say that Rourke is concerned for his dignity, his reputation, his honor? I mean, you say reputation, you're sticking that in there, that's fantastic. So, You see that honor is what we would have to call a huge package deal. It concludes many good real virtues plus some arbitrary commands plus social approval. Or putting it wider and using terms that I think you're familiar with as objectivists, to have honor, you must practice certain objective virtues. You must follow many intrinsicist commands, and you also have to gain subjective social approval. So we have here a mixture of the objective, the intrinsicist, and the subjective that no one but an objectivist could even untangle. Now, if this is your package deal approach to morality, you obviously have plenty of room for conflict within and between individuals. Arbitrary commandments are necessarily going to clash at some point with the requirements of survival and reason. If honor involves intrinsicist commands, then to that extent, the individual must place something above life and reason. He must be obedient to those commands, and that's the very opposite of self-assertion or individuality. He has to, in effect, do what his socioeconomic class at birth dictates, and he has to do it, period. And if we then toss in that besides that he has to gain posterity's approval, it's still worse. The self that he's asserting turns to that extent into Peter Keating. So we have a tragic mixture here. A selfish, individualistic passion for morality defined dominantly in feudal social terms. And here again you see what happens to a noble mind and soul without a moral code. There's no Christianity anymore. There's nothing else. What to do? They just don't know. And that is the downfall time after time, before Christianity and Sophocles and after. The desperate need for a moral code to implement their exalted sense of life, and they can't do it because they don't have it. Now, I want to make sure that you understand here this contrast between Corneille's view and objectivism. I'll put the question to you this way. Would John Galt ever say, "My honor is more precious than my life"? No. Using those terms, he would say, "Life is impossible without honor." In other words, virtue for him is a means of survival. It is not a form of bravery that may defy your own safety. Now, Corneille, for all of his selfishness, does, in effect, end up, despite himself, saying sacrifice. Because he says, in effect, sacrifice your life as necessary for the sake of obedience to an arbitrary code imposed on you. Now, that idea is clearly at war with the individualistic moral self-assertiveness of his better intention. And now you can probably understand why and not be surprised to know that Corneille was born Catholic, and he was a good Catholic all his life, and his plays never got him in any trouble with the church. He was accepted as a good Catholic, despite his utter repudiation of original sin and his heroic view of man. And I think you see now that there's enough of an element of intrinsicism in Corneille and of sacrifice so that he was not regarded as a threat to his religion. And you see how he struggled to combine his Catholicism with his individualism. Let me ask you, to be sure the contrast here is clear, what is a proper objectivist response to a slap in the face? Is it a duel? What's the word?
A lawsuit.
No, it's not a law. That's the American response. The American response to everything is a lawsuit. No. What, in one word, would you have to tell me if I said, what's the proper response to a slap in the face?
Context.
Context. What's the context? What if it's Francisco and Reardon? The proper response of the one slapped is turning away and saying, within your knowledge, you're right. Or the proper response, if he's bigger than you, might be to run for your life. Or call the police, etc. There is obviously no absolute mandate. You must avenge your honor, even if it leads to your death, which is the futile idea, the intrinsicist idea. On that kind of premise, everyone's honor is a danger to everyone else. For example, I get mad at something you did. Well, that's to my credit. You insulted me, and I have the honor to protest. And then I strike you as retaliation, which is honorable. And you demand a duel, which is honorable. In other words, every falling out or a heated disagreement entails the ultimate death of one of the participants. Now, on this view, you could certainly believe that there has to be conflict among individuals, all of whom cherish and practice the same moral code. And this is why I feel that the ending of Lacide is unfortunately oblique or at best implicit. Because the underlying philosophy doesn't lead to a happy ending. And here is the paradox of Corneille. The play's situation is so complex, the obstacles to true love are so diabolical, that it would kill the play if the lovers simply gave in and separated. So for drama, they have to win out. On the other hand, the philosophy which sets up the situation doesn't really allow them to win out. So Corneille is trapped between his own drama and sense of life on the one hand and the logic of his implicit theme on the other. And that, to me, explains the peculiarly mild, implicit, somewhat ambiguous ending. Now, just a few concluding remarks on Corneille's philosophy. On the one hand, he is a strong champion of what we would call a benevolent universe. As one of these commentators puts it, quote, he wants to inspire in his audiences not fear or pity, but hope and admiration. And to this extent, that ends the quote. He's the opposite of a Catholic believing in original sin. But in total, he is torn between religion and this earth. Between man, the pawn of destiny. In the case of this play, it's not God, the destiny, but socioeconomic fate. But he's still torn between man, the pawn of destiny, and man, the self-directed hero. So in this broad sense, you can properly compare Corneille to Sophocles. You can't to Shakespeare, because Shakespeare gave up all hope of man as a self-directed hero. He just wrote it off, so he has no conflict. But Corneille and Sophocles, like Sophocles, is still fighting for human dignity, but hasn't broken through to a code of values that would make it consistently possible. So here is his philosophy in a nutshell. Man is a hero. The universe is benevolent. Reason is our guide. Passion is its expression. Morality is a supreme value. And then he has no code of morality except fierce pride in obeying a package deal resting ultimately on sacrifice and social status. So I think of him as like a bird born to soar, actually soaring and fighting to stay aloft, but with a broken wing. I think he's happier than Sophocles. Thanks to the Renaissance, he's less dominated by God. But philosophically, Corneille still has a very long journey to travel. Despite this, however, he is capable of affording immense pleasure and inspiration. If you discover and read his works, which I hope you will, thank you very much. Now I'm going to make a point of ending exactly on time today to prove to you that I can. Particularly because the play next time, The Schiller, is one of the longest plays in all history. It is twice the length of any Shakespearean play. And therefore, in preparation for that, I want the memory in your mind that we did stop on time once. So we have ample time for question period, and I even have a few questions here in case you don't ask that I want to throw in. But let's start with some real questions. Ed.
Was Ayn Rand, do you know, inspired by Fernandy?
Well, I don't know her own knowledge or reaction to Corneille. I think from her extensive education combined with the fact that she knew French extremely well, she read it and spoke it fluently, that she would be familiar with it. And I don't believe she would disagree with anything that I said. But if I regret anything in my life, it is 30 years of incredibly long conversations with her in which I never discussed theater, only philosophy. So it's not fair for me to ascribe to her what I don't personally know. She did not have Corneille in her works in French in her library. But she had a tremendous education in Russian. She read, for instance, all of Shakespeare in Russian before she left Russia. Everything. So I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if she knew Corneille. But, you know, I never knew that she liked Mona Vanna during her lifetime. I found out just by accident through her correspondence. We just had a very delimited relationship. I always came with 100 philosophic questions. And then there was the 100 questions that those questions generated. I really regret that I never found that out. I know what I would ask her second if she came back to life, and it would be about the theater. The first thing I'd ask is, what does she think of my book on objectivism? Yes?
Do you see any balance between the ending of either January 16th and
You'll have to explain that one to me. No, I don't, because the ending of the night of January 16th is deliberately left for the audience to decide. They're supposed to use their sense of life to interpret what went on, so it's deliberately, the evidence is left equally balanced, and the verdict is up to you to decide. That's a stunt. That's not a philosophic ambiguity on her part. This is a different thing. His heart wants him to have them come on stage after all of it, and in a final embrace with a huge kiss, you know, and fading into the sunset. And the problem is he can't do it, partly because he's not allowed to keep them on stage that long. Secondly, I don't think they're allowed to kiss on stage. But thirdly, he has the philosophic problems that he can't fully resolve. So he's got a problem as an author. It's not a stunt. At the back, yes. Are we not using these mics anymore? Is that it? I don't care. I can hear you. They're not available.
They are available.
Oh, they are available. So if you want to walk up to the mic, people can hear what you ask.
Oh, yeah. Lick, I'm casting myself in the role of a Cornelial hero.
Excuse me, I can't make out one word
you're saying. Good. It's my accent, but we'll just have to do our best, I guess.
Okay.
Like, I'm casting myself in the role of a Cornelian hero here because I do have a criticism of your critique. And despite the slings and arrows that are likely to rain down upon me, I just want to express this.
This is a preface. Okay, now we're getting
to it. It is.
Okay, go ahead.
Look, Rodrigo's father, my problem is this. You made the comment that all the characters within the terms of the time were good.
Yeah.
G-O-O-D. I question that because there's no mention in the play here about Rodrigo's father being a quadriplegic. They just mention that he was old.
Yeah.
Now, the point here is that he could have fought, but he would have lost. That's the point I'd make. Further, what he then does, can I just finish this a second?
Sure.
What he then does is he puts his own kid in the front line instead of fighting and losing, despite the fact that he knows that his son's love for Zamina, the daughter, will be irreprovably damaged, whatever turns out. And the last point is, so one is that the father is not a good character in the terms of his own time, because he won't fight for himself, because he might lose.
Okay, I think
and secondly, that if that point's conceded, then the play won't proceed from there.
I think that I won't rain down arrows on you for that question, but I regard that as perhaps a textbook example of what I would call pettifogging. That is to say, taking a tiny and highly debatable point and turning it into an essential. As I interpret it, and undoubtedly Corneille does, the father is really too old to fight with dignity. Now remember, it is not enough to satisfy the code that they strap him onto the back of the horse and that, you know, he's teetering from Alzheimer's and they run him through. That would be farce. He's got to have enough vitality so he can put up a fight. And this is a young, strapping, new, you know, right-hand man of the king. It's so unbalanced that it would be a violation of the feudal code for him to do it. So he's put in the position that he's just beyond the point. Now, I have to say, having said all this, that it really is a trifling point, because we simply have to get to the point where the son has to do it. And I think the father makes very clear that he would do anything if he could, and you just have to. Maybe this is the point to invoke the fact that these are meant to be acted, not read. What I am doing basically is reading aloud the score to a concerto or a symphony, and I'm saying A flat follows B minor, and so on and so on, and rather than playing the music for you, because I have no orchestra. And that's all we can do in these courses, you know, as my title is, Great Plays as Philosophy and as Literature, not as theater. Because we can't act them out. So it's like great scores, but not as music. If this thing is properly acted, then he has to be cast, this gentleman. The contrast between the two has to be such that you don't have to wonder, is he a coward or whatever? It becomes obvious from looking at this old gray-haired man bent over and so on that he couldn't possibly engage in conflict. But I think that's ample time. Let me now raise a question. This is something that I cut from the lecture, but happily there's time to put it back. I want to be sure that you make a clear distinction between identifying somebody's philosophy and evaluating the philosophy from the point of view of objectivism. In other words, there's a big difference between naming the philosophic theme of a play and evaluating that theme from the point of view of objectivism. The philosophic theme of a play is an objective fact. It's the same for everyone regardless of their philosophy. The evaluation of that theme will vary from person to person according to what the evaluator's philosophy is. Now, I want to show you on this very play why you must not mix these up, otherwise you'll never have an objective interpretation of a play. You will always see only the play as interpreted by Ayn Rand, or the play as interpreted by St. Augustine, or the play as interpreted by Kant, but not the play. Now, and if you don't have the play, that means there's no such thing as an interpretation. Everybody's living in his own interpretation and there's no reality. Now, in this play, for instance, to make it very brief, Corneille presents an intrinsicist code, at least partly intrinsicist, and an unresolved ending. Let's just take those points. His explicit message is honor comes above life. Now that much is entirely objective. It's not a matter of your interpretation. Now comes interpretation from your own philosophy. And let me give you three different interpretations of the identical facts with complete agreement on the theme and the problem of the end. One, an objectivist watches this play and says, as I did in the class, well, it's the intrinsicist element in his moral code which leads him to uncertainty and potential malevolence. But now I had, in my preliminary seminar, I deliberately put in some non-objectivists because I wanted to get a feeling for the reaction to these plays among people who weren't objectivists. And this is a gentleman that I very highly respect and like, who is, in his own way, a relativist. And he said, the trouble with Corneille, the reason we had a long discussion about the ending, he said the reason is that it's his absolutism which is causing the problem with this ending. Because absolutism is just not applicable in reality. It's impracticable. And that's why the characters just can't resolve the situation at the end. Now, you see, I would never have dreamed to come up with that interpretation. But that is a legitimate interpretation if relativism is a correct philosophy. You see? We still agree on what is the theme of the play. What are the problems of the play? But now he comes with an entirely different philosophic explanation. And I have to say, well, I disagree with your explanation because I disagree with your philosophy. But we agree about the fact about the play. So I'm not saying that your interpretation is subjective or arbitrary, but I am saying you have to keep an absolute line in your mind. What does Corneille represent? What does he say? What is his theme? Versus, what do I, as an objectivist, think of it? And how do I interpret the flaws and so on, the virtues that it makes possible? You have to know whether you're identifying his thought or yours. And if you don't keep that line clear, you have no hope of ever reaching an objective assessment of a play. Now, there's other ones. For instance, if we brought St. Augustine in, that I have no doubt, and he watched this play, and we said to him, how do you explain the ending? He'd say, how do you expect people to ever achieve happiness or fulfillment if you ignore God? This is a completely secular play. Of course they're all going to end up frustrated and unhappy. You see what I mean? So here again, he would see the same theme, the same events, but he would have a completely different interpretation. Now, this kind of disagreement does not show that you can't know the objective analysis of a play. But it does show that to do it, you have to know the facts first and keep your evaluation distinct. Now, having said that, I'm going to ask you a question that I was asked in the preliminary class, which really blew my head off. I mean, I couldn't believe this question. So I hope the person who asked it doesn't hear this on the tape. But this was the question I was asked, and I want to be 100% sure that everyone in this room understands the fatal error in this question. Because it's on the very same point of the distinction between the play and your interpretation. This was the question. We had just done Shakespeare, and then we did Corneille, just as here. I'm going to just make it. He said, Shakespeare says that morality is irrelevant to life. Corneille says morality leads to agonizing conflict and possibly tragedy. Can we not then conclude that Shakespeare and Corneille agree philosophically? Because after all, if morality leads to conflict and tragedy, who needs it? For life's purposes, it's irrelevant. Did you get that question? Should I repeat that? Shakespeare says morality is irrelevant. Corneille says it leads to conflict and probably tragedy. Well, if so, who needs it? So practically speaking, for Corneille, morality is just as irrelevant as it is for Shakespeare, And therefore, both Corneille and Shakespeare agree philosophically. They have the same theme and the same viewpoint. I just fell out of my chair when that question was asked. I never heard such a disastrous question. Now, why is that bad? I don't mean morally bad, I mean, but what is the tremendous error of that question? If you don't see it, then yes, Benson.
He would be combining two very different views of man and his relationship to morality just by their consequences.
And according to what? He's combining two different views, two opposite views, by the fact that from a point of view of objectivism, they're ultimately going to lead to the same thing. But that is completely unfair. He's making their thought something that you can't grasp except through the objectivist categories. And that amounts to saying there's only two themes in world literature, or in all thought, Ayn Rand and everybody else. You know, that's just like the mentality of the guy that burned the ancient Alexandrian library on the grounds of it's in the Quran, it's superfluous, if it's not, it's heretical, so get rid of it. And he just burned everything. Now that is dogmatism to the core. And what I'm trying to show you is that you have to appreciate, if you read this play, Corneille does not sneer at morality. Shakespeare does. Corneille thinks it's the primary value to which men should aspire, and Shakespeare says, what fools these mortals be. Corneille reveres virtue above all else and wants a world where virtue is rewarded, which is the opposite of Shakespeare, who presents morality as utterly impotent. Any morality, any virtue, or any vice on the part of any character. Now, it's a completely distinct fact that Corneille's moral code doesn't work, that it isn't practical. And you, from the outside, can say, well, his code, since it doesn't work, is going to lead people to the idea that morality is irrelevant. So he's going to inadvertently, unknowingly, end up giving support to Shakespeare. That's one thing. That's your side commentary as an objectivist commentator. That is utterly different than saying this is Corneille's meaning or message. You get this point? It's very, very important that you not make this error. Okay, let's go back to another question. Somebody who hasn't asked anything up to now in the whole course? Yes.
Without the package deal of honor, wouldn't there have to be far less conflict in this story? And if that's the case, what does that do for the hypothetical modern version of this?
Well, that's a very good question. If I did this play in the modern one without the package deal of honor, where would I get all the conflict from? Well, as I said, all the conflict hinges on ignorance. And the problem would have to be creating a situation of an emergency situation where they have to act without the knowledge available to them. But then what would diminish the play, and the thing that actually stopped me from finally doing it, was it would lose a very significant resonance or universality. It would become kind of an odd case, you know, of what happens in a crisis. So it could be exciting and so on, but it would not have, that I could see, a universal theme. Because as soon as I tried to make a universal theme out of that clash, what would I be clashing with? You see, I couldn't make it love versus honor. And if it's love versus justice, the resolution in objectivist terms has to finally be, well, what's the facts? When the facts come out, then justice and love have to point in the same direction. If he's innocent, don't prosecute him, and you should love each other. And if he's guilty, then you got to prosecute him, and the woman has to say, if my father is guilty of a crime, I don't hold out for his vengeance, you see, just because he's my father. So in that sense, if you held an objectivist code on this situation, even as modernized, you could only get away with it by making it an emergency and withholding the final resolution or the facts from the audience. And that would blunt the importance of your message. And that's one of the things that stopped me. It would be like a gimmick that you could get away with for TV, you see. I never even thought of it as far really for the movies. Because it would be like one of those Twilight Zones, you know, where you'd have a twist and then fade out. I think it would be a 30-minute thing. If you tried to drag it out too long, you'd be sunk by your own problem, you see. So that's a very intelligent question. That's what happens to you if you try to adapt somebody's play to your own terms. I only did that to show you, you see, that there is a wider meaning here. But to actually carry it out is a different thing. Yes?
What's the origin of the philosophical origin of this intrinsic personal view of honor?
What do you mean by personal in that sense?
Well, just honor.
Oh, you mean the feudal idea? Well, the best that I know is the asking the philosophic origin of this idea of personal honor. Now, you don't mean personal honor in the sense that Aristotle, you know, the Roman heroes had a definite code of honor, but we're talking about the feudal sense of honor. That goes back to the breakup of the ancient world. Inherent in the dichotomy between noble and commoner, you know, which did not exist in the ancient world. They had master and slave in the ancient world, but they did not have noble versus peasant or noble versus commoner. And that distinction actually originated in the breakup of the ancient world when the barbarian tribes were pouring in. Law and order had basically collapsed. And your only way of survival was to ally yourself with some powerful warrior. Powerful strictly in terms of the number of, you know, horses and men and muscles that he could put on his side. And they came to be regarded as noble absolutely strictly by courtesy of physical brutality. You know, if you were the physical champion, you were the Lord. And if you were dependent on him, you were just a commoner. And that distinction of nobility and superior class actually goes back to warfare, physical warfare for survival. So what we call noble is the most materialistic of concepts in the crude physicalistic sense in terms of its historical origin. Now, of course, when you get many centuries later, particularly when it's hallowed by the church and sanctified, and you know, you mix into it that they don't do any work and they just, they're the educated ones, etc., it takes on a different and higher meaning. But actually, the philosophic origin of the concept of a sense of honor as a nobleman, it goes back to the lowest brutality. I have an answer, but if you have a question, I mean, that I also cut out, but if you have a question, well, I'll give you one and I'll take one, because there's something else I cut out that I wanted to get in. Have you, either of you asked a question before?
I have.
Well, let me give it to the final one to you then. Go ahead.
Thank you. The hero killing the heroine's father takes place very early in the play, and mm-hmm. it's the action that sets up the basic conflict that occurs between the two main characters for the rest of the play. Why do you state the plot theme in the terms of that original action, which more or less just sets up the situation?
Well, because that's what a plot theme does. The purpose of a plot theme is not to tell you what happens, but to tell you the situation. The plot theme is not a summary of the action. The plot theme is, what is the central action conflict? What is the event, the kind of event on which the play revolves? Now, in this case, the situation is precisely, he has to kill her father to retain his morality. Now, whether we put in the plot theme, he does kill the father or he has to kill the father. Doesn't make any difference, because the action follows immediately on the decision, and then the whole play revolves around that action. You see what I mean? The whole play actually begins from the moment when she says, "My God, he killed my father." And he says, "My God, I killed her father." And then they go from there. So let me put it to you another way. The fact that something is early doesn't disqualify it from being a plot theme. The plot theme has to be established at the beginning. And therefore, very often there is a major event which is required. In fact, in every case that I can think of, a major event must take place in order to establish the situation. For instance, Creon has to decree the crime and she has to bury the brother before you got them engaged. And the same is true, as you'll see throughout the various plays. As a matter of fact, in Don Carlos, which we're going to do on Saturday, they're act after act to get the situation established. There's subplots. You don't get the situation established until well into Act 3. So whatever is required to get the characters engaged in a conflict goes into the plot theme. But what happens to that conflict or what further actions is not part of the plot theme. That's the development. Now, let me conclude here with, and I'll try to take you maybe next time if we can, because we don't have to make every question always on the play of that day. You know, you can go back to a preceding play. I want to toss in, because I know several of you are interested, a word on classicism. Just to give you a little background, this is the only classicist in our course. Classicism consisted of concrete rules, usually applied to buildings and theater, music, allegedly taken from the ancients, and rules that had to be obeyed no matter what the subject or theme. Now, you know that as far as the standards of art is concerned, philosophically, there are three different approaches. There's the subjectivist who says there are no rules. Anything goes, whatever you feel. There's the objectivist who says art has to be created and judged by abstract principles which have to be defended by the essential nature and role of art, but they have to be applied within the context of the theme and the subject. And then, of course, there is the intrinsicist in art who says there are specific rules derived from authorities apart from context, apart from any discussion of the nature or practical purpose of art. It's like the Ten Commandments of aesthetics. Now, it shows you a certain consistency here that in ethics, as we've seen, there's a large element of intrinsicism in Corneille, in the feudal commandments. And so he is consistent in having a large element of intrinsicism stylistically in his classicism as well. They go together as a certain kind of mentality. He was trying to uphold standards as against subjectivism and skepticism, but does not know how to do it except ultimately to go back to authority. Although they break these rules in both cases freely to try to breathe life and heroism and beauty into the work. Now, if you looked at the actual rules of classicism, they're basically like the Ten Commandments of the Bible. It's a mixture of good points, silly points, overstated points, points that are ambiguous and need interpretation. I'm going to mention in closing here just one from 17th century French and give you an idea. A play must be dignified. Now, that sounds good to me. And you can see what the reasoning was. They wanted a value-oriented, rational world. They didn't want anything debased. They wanted something dignified. Now, what did it mean? Now, here was a list of what was prohibited by that principle. No foul language. No colloquialisms. No mention of low objects like handkerchiefs or even daggers. No violence, not even a duel. No details of everyday life. You couldn't eat on stage, drink on stage, sleep on stage. You see the furor over Chamin's meeting with Rodrigo at home at night. That is just simply not dignified. Now that gives you a taste of the kind of thing that Corneille accepted, or he accepted at least in part, in the name of staying true to a rational, orderly, logical universe. It's another example of the difference between rationalism, which dominated France at this period, and reason. Despite all this, I still want to restate in conclusion, classicism made possible some great poetry and some great plays. And in my judgment, Le Cid is among the immortals in those respects. Thank you very much.